Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, the collection of headlines on a whole variety of sites, Drudge being, you know, just for example, the right-wing website. Interesting. The nominee is the headline of the photo of Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle. The congressional source, Hillary Clinton, having trouble finding superdelegates who will meet with her. No one wants to see her today. But perhaps most important, here are these headlines. 27% of Republican voters voted against McCain in North Carolina. 23% of Republican voters voted against McCain in Indiana. Republicans on Hill shell-shocked and broke. But, of course, the important news. The important news.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Yes, well, not ghost chickens, but the ghost pigeons. Those of you who are longtime listeners of this program know that I have this theory that pigeons... See, whenever pigeons are actually robots from the planet Xenu... who are here to spy on us. You see, whenever there's a meeting of world leaders anywhere in the world, what do you see? Pigeons, all kinds of pigeons. Whenever important people gather, there are pigeons there. Every 6 months, maybe every year, but probably every 6 months, the mothership from the planet Xenu comes down and drops off a whole new load of robotic pigeons with little tape recorders in their brains, or where their brains should be, and they... get all the information about what's happening. And then they, you know, every 6 months they take them back up and upload the information and drop down a whole new load of pigeons. And the proof, of course, is that you never see a dead pigeon or a baby pigeon. And wherever there's important people, there's pigeons. And so, anyhow, some whack job in Seattle has taken it upon himself to start attacking pigeons with dart guns. And oddly enough, and there's a photo of this on our homepage at tomhartman.com, although the article here is in NationalGeographic.com, and pigeons in Seattle, Washington are under attack by an unknown assailant with a dart gun, officials say. And local authorities have received several reports of pigeons found in the city center with 3 to 4 inch metal darts through their skulls and lodged behind their eyes. But the pigeons are still alive, at least many of them. And so, you know, obviously it's tongue-in-cheek, but it's... I don't know. How do these pigeons survive this with a dart in their brains? They're still running. Well, it must be maybe only some of them are robots. Maybe the vast majority of it, but there's a few real ones. Every now and then somebody will call in and they'll say, "Well, we saw it actually a baby pigeon." I said, no, that's a painted baby, you know, duck or something or dove or something. Anyhow, back to the campaign. Last night Hillary Clinton had a small victory in Indiana, and Barack Obama had a very large victory in South Carolina. David Axelrod, Obama's chief strategist, this is about the whole Limbaugh thing. You know, was there an Operation Chaos factor? Was there? You know, did it have to do with anything? And David Axelrod saying, Obama's chief strategist, that 4 in 10 Democrats who said they would vote for McCain over Clinton in a general election, nonetheless voted for Clinton on Tuesday. Citing this figure, the Obama campaign sent an email to reporters last night arguing that 7% of the Indiana electorate could be attributed to the Limbaugh effect. That's 41% of the 17% who said that they'd vote for McCain over Clinton but nonetheless voted for Clinton in the primary. So this is going to be a tough one. This is going to be a tough one for Hillary Clinton. My personal take on this is that where she's going from here forward is she has two primaries that in all probability she's a virtual certainty that she will be winning, West Virginia and Kentucky, and Oregon. I'm broadcasting here live from the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush refers to our fair city of Portland, Oregon, and Odds are Oregon will go for Barack Obama, although, you know, I was in one of the, down in Coos County over the weekend in Coquiel and Bandon and these little towns along the seacoast, and Bill Clinton had been down there. It was like a rock star had come to town. So, and Hillary's coming back to the state. So they're doing some campaigning here. But the odds are that Oregon is going to go for Obama. West Virginia and Kentucky will go for Clinton. And as a consequence of this, my guess is, my take on all this is that Hillary Clinton in all probability will not pull out of the race until May 20th, until after the May 20th primary. And that will allow her to go out on a high note. She has some fundraising she has to do between now and then. And also, I think that there's some healing that needs to be done within the party between now and then. And frankly, I saw the beginning of that last night. And I thought that actually there were some very, very good and high points that were made by Hillary Clinton in her victory speech, as well as by Barack Obama. Barack Obama, some of the things that he had to say last night.
You know, there are those who were saying that North Carolina would be a game changer in this election. But today, what North Carolina decided is that the only game that needs changing is the one in Washington, D.C.
And you'll
because
notice
you came out in the bitter cold and knocked on doors and enlisted your friends and neighbors in this cause. Because you stood up to the cynics and the doubters and the naysayers when we were up and when we were down. Because you still believe that this is our moment and our time to change America. Tonight we stand less than 200 delegates away from securing the Democratic nomination for President of the United States.
And I can tell you there's a lot of superdelegates who are just, you know, hanging on, but time will tell. But the conventional wisdom is that there are a lot of superdelegates who are waiting for an appropriate opportunity to come out in support of Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton, however, a strong candidate. And as I said, I think that this is going to be, you know, she's going to pull. I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. My guess is that she's going to pull the negative attack ads against Barack Obama. She's going to be promoting her vision of America, which is not that different from Barack Obama's. I mean, these are two good, solid Democrats. She's going to be attacking John McCain. She's going to be doing the things that you know, are entirely appropriate things for a Democratic candidate to be doing. Her victory speech last night in Indiana.
Not too long ago, my opponent made a prediction. He said I would probably win Pennsylvania. He would win North Carolina. And Indiana would be the tiebreaker. Well, tonight we've come from behind. We've broken the tie. And thanks to you, it's full speed onto the White House.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I suspect a little more bluster there than anything else.
This has been an extraordinary experience, traveling across Indiana.
Notice the past tense. This has been.
Having an opportunity to meet so many of you. And for everyone who holds your breath at the gas pump, afraid to see how much it costs today. And for everyone working day and night because you want the world for your kids. For every young person with big dreams who deserves a world of opportunity. And for all those who aren't in the headlines but have always written America's story, tonight is your victory right here.
And I think that that's very much the case, whether it's the victory for Indiana for Hillary Clinton. And I don't mean to diminish it by pointing out that Axelrod is saying that there was the Limbaugh factor, because nonetheless, she got an awful lot of votes in both states and certainly has won a number of other states. But whether it was Hillary Clinton or whether it was Barack Obama, these victories are real. We had in South Carolina, more people, or North Carolina rather, more people showed up to vote in the primary than voted in the general election for John Kerry. I mean, that's an absolutely staggering number. Hillary Clinton continued.
I want to commend Senator Obama and his supporters on their win in North Carolina. You know, we are in many ways on the same journey.
See, this is the healing.
It's a journey begun long before we were born. It is a journey by men and women who have been on a mission to perfect our union, who marched and protested, who risked everything they had to build an America that embraces us all. And tonight, once again, I need your help to continue our journey.
And you know, obviously asking people to go to HillaryClinton.com and that kind of thing. But that healing message, it's beginning. I think this is a healthy moment. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Happy birthday to you.
Oh, my. Well, this is what happens when your wife is in charge of doing the bumpers. Thank you, Louise. It's the 36th anniversary of my 21st birthday today, indeed. Fox News, this an absolute crazy alert. I'm telling you, they're totally nuts over there. Here you got a couple of millionaires, Britt Hume, Fred Barnes, Mort Kondracki. Three millionaires sitting around talking about how working people, union workers, working people in the United States, middle class people are actually the lower class.
I think that the better question is, what about these so-called downscale voters that we were talking about earlier with Fred?
Fred Barnes
has a view that all those who support...
Yes, let's have some millionaires ask another millionaire about these working class...
For Hillary Clinton, are downscale. And so I think we ought to get Fred to further elaborate on his view that they're all downscale.
Yes, Fred, let's ask you.
Well, stop chuckling. Mort couldn't explain it, but I can explain to you why we use the phrase working class.
See, Moore couldn't say it because it's just, politically incorrect, you know.
It is a euphemism because it's kind of mean to say lower class. It's as simple as that. That's why we call it working class. Everybody knows who we're talking about. We're talking about, Moore, forget it. We're talking about
lower class, lower income, less education. You're not talking about social class,
yeah,
are you?
That too.
Really?
Yeah, we're talking lower social class.
In the United States of America, working people, union members, are regarded as middle class. Maybe lower middle class, but middle class. Lower class people are the, by definition, poverty stricken, and these working class Democrats and working class whites and the rest of them are not.
They're middle class.
See, there's that's Fred Barnes trying to calm down Mort, saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we're not going to call these people these names." And yeah, we sure are going to call them those names.
Fred, don't quit missing them all the time. I rest my case.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're going to leave you out there with the downscale people and calling them lower class. And
That's Britt Hume.
You know that we here on this panel do not unanimously endorse that sentiment that we're all for working families, particularly. And that we and those of you who are working families out there, we appeal to you to bear with us. Thank you very much.
Yes, please bear with us as Fox News calls working people the lower classes. Please bear with them. Glenn Beck bringing on his phony caller for Honky Whitesville. Honky Whitesville is this guy's name? To trash Michelle Obama for 15 minutes. I mean, this is incredible. Limbaugh going off on his nasty, bigoted, racist remarks about Mayor Villaraigosa. And, on it goes. I mean, this is all the Republicans have to campaign on. This is it. They've got fear of the other. They've got divide and conquer. They've got these fundamentally anti-American strategies that they're going to be using. And this is what they're going to be using. And the Democrats are both, frankly, to a large extent, I would say 95% of what Hillary Clinton has been saying and certainly 95% of what Barack Obama has been saying, not directed against each other, but directed toward the positive vision of America. Barack Obama last night.
The people that I've met in small towns and big cities across this country understand that government can't solve all our problems, and we don't expect it to. We believe in hard work. We believe in personal responsibility.
Well, except for, you know, Fred Barnes, who believes that if you work hard, you're the lower class.
And self-reliance. But we also believe that we have a larger responsibility to one another as Americans. That America is a place. That America is the place where you can make it if you try. That no matter how much money you start with or where you come from or who your parents are, opportunity is yours if you're willing to reach for it and work for it. It's the idea that while there are few guarantees in life, you should be able to count on a job that pays the bills. Health care for when you need it, a pension when you retire, an education for your children that will allow them to fulfill their God-given potential. That's the America we believe in. That's the America that we know.
See, that's the America that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have been talking about. That's the America the Democrats get and understand. Obama also talking about the oil, the dependence upon oil. It's funny, both sides of the war.
The man I met in Pennsylvania who lost his job but can't even afford the gas to drive around and look for a new one. He can't afford four more years of an energy policy written by the oil companies and for the oil companies. A policy that's not only keeping gas at record prices, but funding both sides of the war on terror and destroying our planet. He doesn't need four more years of Washington policies that sound good but don't solve the problem. He needs us to take a permanent holiday from our addiction from oil by making the automakers raise their fuel standards, corporations pay for their pollution, and oil companies invest their record profits in a clean energy future. That's the change we need. That's why I'm running for president of the United States of America.
There's a couple of extraordinary speeches last night. 27 minutes past the hour. Your thoughts, 866-303-2270. Our phone number, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
You know, another example of, here on this program, we talk about things like the importance of Social Security as an insurance program against not only old age poverty, but, you know, everything from birth defects to disaster. I mean, just plain old flat-out disaster. One of my best friends broke his neck. He's living on Social Security. So, in fact, a third of people who take Social Security, who get Social Security, are not retired. They are literally widows, orphans, and disabled people. We talk about the importance of having a social safety net in the United States. We talk about the importance of this being a we society, not a me society. We talk about the importance of supporting our soldiers, particularly as they come back from combat. Whereas you've got people like John McCain out there saying, no, he's not going to sign on to the new GI Bill of Rights. You know, we can't have that. All right across the board, all the social programs, so making sure our water is clean, to our air is clean, to our infrastructure is intact, to our public transportation systems, to our cars get good gas mileage, to carcinogens are not in the atmosphere and the environment and in our food supply. All of these things, by and large, are considered by cons to be socialism, big government. And I would submit to you that they are intrinsic to the American worldview. This is how America was started. Well, if you're opposed to all those things, if your worldview is, well, the government has no business doing any of that kind of thing, what do you have left to campaign on? These guys are not going to campaign on that they're all in favor of ExxonMobil being more and more powerful, that monopolies should get bigger and bigger, that big transnational corporations should define our trade policies. To hell with what it means to the average American worker. So what are they going to do? They're going to run on things like racism. Glenn Beck yesterday.
We're talking to Honky Whitesville from the Obama campaign.
You just said a white campaign advisor.
Yeah. I mean, this is obviously a contrived piece. This guy, this went on for 15 minutes. Obviously, I'm not going to play that whole thing.
Your pardon?
I just want to make sure you get the title. I'm the white campaign advisor. I'm white.
Yeah, we're supposed to be
really
laughing hysterically, you see.
Mr. Whitesville.
Well, it's important to, just important to, you know, to be truthful. I'm white. I'm a white man.
But that's okay.
I just want to make sure you
but it doesn't,
know.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, right. And then he talks about, I'm the same color as toothpaste, blah, 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 blah. And then they start going after Michelle Obama. And holy cow, you know, she went to good colleges. How could that be?
And they're, as always, they're trying to raise the bar a little higher. Like they did when she went to Princeton and then Harvard. And now possibly the first lady.
Is it possible she was holding onto the bar as they were raising it?
No, I think she might have made a trip to the bar.
Oh, yeah, she's just an alcoholic. I mean, that's just, this is so, so pathetic. John in New Jersey. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? The reason I'm calling is I saw that clip, too. And, yeah, there's often a stereotype that about Democrats that most, if not all, are dirt poor. They're working for Walmart or pumping gas. The reason why I'm calling, I work for a big company. I make a lot of money. I am very – if Obama gets elected, my taxes are going to go up a little bit. I know that. I'm okay with that. The reason I'm very sincere about this – that kind of haughty, pompous, hate-filled stuff that Glenn Beck did, if that doesn't disgust people in this country, I don't know what will. That is stunningly hideous. And the reason why I'm saying that, there are a lot of people I know that are like me. We're not all poor. We're not all unemployed. We don't work for Walmart. We're doing very well, but that is morally offensive. And I just often think that Democrats are often characterized that that we forget there are a lot of people that are doing okay, actually, economically, could do better, but that we find that offensive because that's morally offensive. And that's all I want to say.
You said it very well, John. Thank you very much. There's also this phenomenon. You've got a lot of middle-class voters and working-class voters who are saying, no, please don't raise my taxes. And the reason why, and this is the point that is not made by the corporate media, and there's a very good reason why this is not made by the corporate media. The reason why is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, the percentage of people's income that was being paid, working people's income, middle class people's income that was being paid in taxes overall, from property taxes to income taxes at the state and federal level to FICA, was dramatically lower. Ronald Reagan doubled, for example, the taxes on working people, just on, at that time, people making less than $35,000 a year, and now about $100,000 a year. Ronald Reagan doubled that tax at the same time that he cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires. So what we have seen is this massive shift. John Kennedy dropped when FDR raised the top tax rate to 91%, there was no outcry among average working Americans because they got it, that you had to be making $3.6 million before it affected you. Kennedy dropped that down to 71%. It was still something that really only affected the very wealthy, and Kennedy positioned it as a tax increase because he was closing loopholes. But what's happened since Reagan came into office is there has been a series of tax cuts for millionaires, billionaires, and large corporations, to the point that as Berkshire Hathaway, one of the largest investment funds in the United States, as they pointed out in their annual report, and I quote, taxes, corporate taxes, are at the lowest level since 1934. 7.4% of all federal tax receipts, down from 32% in 1952. So in 1952, the corporations in America were paying 32% of the tax load. Wealthy people in the United States were paying a good chunk of the tax load, and the average working person was paying a relatively smaller piece of the tax load. Now corporations are only paying 7% of the federal tax load.
The very, very wealthy, if you make your living buying and selling stocks, if you make your living sitting around the pool on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, you have a maximum federal income tax rate of 15%. A maximum rate. Whereas if you're out working for a living, if you're a school teacher, if your spouse is out there building roads, something like that, together you could be paying 30, 35%, 36% in income taxes, plus 100% of your tax is subject to that doubled FICA tax that Reagan dumped on us, whereas millionaires and billionaires are paying nothing on it after the first $100,000 in taxes, in income that they make. Zero. They're paying nothing into the Social Security Income Fund, into FICA and Medicare. Zero. So what's happened is the average working stiff is paying more and more and more in taxes because the rich folks and the corporations in this country have been dramatically paying less and less and less. And so, of course, people are going, hey, I'm paying enough taxes. And then there was that little trick that George W. Bush did in 2001, that neat little trick. You'll recall if you file your income taxes every year and if your taxes are deducted from your paycheck, before the year 2001, most people on April 15 actually got a tax refund, a small tax refund. Since 2001, most people, when they file their taxes, owe a little bit. The reason why? Because Bush changed the tax deduction tables so that people's paychecks got a little bigger. Everybody thought, hey, I got a tax cut. But he didn't actually cut the average person's taxes. Instead, he simply changed the deduction tables. So you got a little less taken out of your paycheck, but at the end of the year, you got hit with a bigger bill, so you'd even be angrier about paying taxes. The average working person in the United States is getting screwed. It has been and has been by the Republicans ever since 1981 when Reagan came into office, and they're angry and they're upset and they don't realize that it's the big multinational corporation. You got corporations like Halliburton and KBR. KBR off, you know, Kellogg Brown and Root reincorporated in the Cayman Islands. Halliburton now in the Middle East, where they pay no federal taxes at all on the hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars that are being given to them, and the profits, the billions of dollars in profits that they're making. And who's paying the taxes? You and me and every average working person in this country. Period. Arnold in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Arnold. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Arnold?
Hey, man. We had a good time at the election yesterday in North Carolina. I had done something that I thought was pretty good. I went to my church, asked my pastor, let me use the church bus, because there was a low-income housing development near there. And these people who, they don't not necessarily on welfare, they work hard every day. They had to work two or three jobs. So I thought it would be nice to get these people rides to the polling place, which is almost on the other side of town. And it worked out pretty good. But I went there with the assumption that these people are not politically knowledgeable like I was, you know, a political junkie like I am. So I took them there. And when we got there, there was two white guys standing at the polling place, you know, trying to discourage them because he saw me making my second trip with these people. And he told the people, said, well, don't you know that Barack Obama's pastor is an evil man and that he's associated himself with also some kind of militant terrorist group? And this young girl who got off the bus, who looked like a single mother, she told this guy, she said, and what do you think about George W. Bush association with the Bin Laden family? I like to fell over, man.
That's great.
I think these people was not
really
connected, you know?
That's great. Good on you, Arnold. Congratulations. There you go. Arnold, our man of the day. You done good. That's great.
All right, buddy. We'll see you.
Thanks a lot for the call. That is amazing.
Didn't you know that Barack Obama's pastor, he's an evil...
What about the fact that George Bush's father was having breakfast with Bin Laden's brother on the morning of 9/11? What a perfect rebuttal. What a perfect rebuttal. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for all things Air America and the blogs over there as well. We have a message board at TomHartman.com as well. Stick around. We'll be right back. A lot coming up today, by the way. Terry Jeffries in our second hour and our third hour, How to Disappear.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
A special heads up, Friday, May 16th, 7 p.m., to our listeners on WCPT in Chicago, I'll be at Frugal Muse Books at 7 p.m. It's a great bookstore down at southeast corner of 75th and Lamont Road in Darien, less than a mile from I-55 and 355. And we'll be doing a book signing and talk and book signing there. The next day I'll be at the Green Festival and also giving a talk there from the main stage and a book signing. So remember, May 16th, 7 p.m. at Frugal Muse Books in Darien. And, of course, the next day, the 17th of May, I'll be over at the Green Festival. So it's going to be a great time in Chicago. Al Gore talking about global warming. Actually, let me leave that until the next hour. We'll pick up a few more phone calls here on this topic. And Mo in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mo.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me, man. First time caller.
Thank you.
So, first of all, snaps to the gentleman from North Carolina for using his church bus to get people to the polls. Wow, amazing initiative, and I love that comeback. That's amazing. It just, I always reel when I hear that people will actually stand at polling places to foster awful, destructive ideas about a candidate.
Right.
I marvel that someone would go to a polling place to foster lies about somebody like Barack Obama. I mean, I live near people that, you know, have come up to me recently and in the same breath said, well, you know he's a practicing Muslim. I said, well, actually, I know he's not. Well, what about his pastor? I'm saying, didn't you just say he's a practicing Muslim? How can he have a pastor if he's a practicing Muslim?
Right. And that's the thing. Oh, but his pastor's a black guy. Isn't that those black Muslims? And this, as I said, this is, as I've said many times in this program, the subtext of the Reverend Wright thing and the reason it's been slammed so hard by the media and particularly by the Republicans and the corporate media is that it's an attempt to associate Barack Obama in the minds of white people as the black guy, as opposed to an American, as opposed to a Democrat, as opposed to the guy who's working for Social Security, as opposed to the guy who's working for job security, as the guy who's working to build the image of America around the world. You know, forget all that stuff. You know, just let's identify him in a racial stereotype. And in fact, let's make that stereotype as bad as possible by dragging the name Louis Farrakhan in at every opportunity. And even, you know, Hamas, in the church pamphlet, which, you know, Obama had nothing to do with. I mean, it wasn't even around. It's just, you know, Mo, spot on. It is awful. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Linda in Vancouver. See, they got nothing to run on. So what are they going to do? They're going to try and tear down our candidates. Linda in Vancouver. Hey, Linda.
Hey, Tom. I just have a quick comment, and then I'll hear what you have to say off the air. But I think perhaps an appropriate, given the context, connection for George Bush's father is Reverend Moon, and then also John McCain's relationship with Pastor Hagee.
Reverend Moon,
getting much attention.
Yeah, one of the first things that George Bush Sr. did after he ceased becoming President of the United States was to go out and essentially campaign with Reverend Moon. Reverend Moon, the guy who says that he's here to replace Jesus Christ, who is paying churches to take down crosses and put up crowns. Reverend Moon, who was crowned in the U.S. Senate. John Warner got a room in the Senate building, I believe it was in the Dirksen building, for a member of Congress to give Moon a crown. I mean, it's... Yeah, and where's the press? Well, the press didn't cover that at all. I mean, they just essentially not at all. Clyde, New Jersey. Hey, Clyde.
Hi. I just want to talk about the delegate counts in the upcoming election. Well, actually, the election that we've done, the primaries. If you take the top 15 states that you know the Democrats are going to win, the top 15 states the Republicans you know are going to win, and then take the 20 states in the middle, it's pretty scary looking at how the delegates go in that direction, because Barack Obama has won pretty much every state. The Democrats aren't going to win in November, except for Tennessee and Oklahoma. So it's pretty scary.
Actually, what it's doing, I'd say it's the exact opposite, Clyde. What it's doing, look at North Carolina, for example, a state that went for Bush. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton got more votes in that state last night than all of the folks who voted Democratic for John Kerry in the election of 2004, in an actual general election, in a primary. More people showed up to vote than voted for the actual nominee in the national election. I would say that what's happening is that states that are considered purple or even red are going to become blue states. Frankly, I think that this is a really good thing. I bottom line. Monique in Los Angeles. Hey, Monique.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Sorry. I was listening to your show this morning, and I just wanted to make the comment that after hearing Hillary's speech last night, I started out as a Hillary supporter. And basically the tactics that she's used, in my opinion, against Obama turned me against her. And I didn't really hear her speech as being a conciliatory speech, or I don't see her bowing out gracefully. In the next couple of primaries, I think she's going to get really dirty.
She said last night that she will support the Democratic nominee, which is, you know, code for she's going to support Barack Obama. Obviously, she can't say it. She hasn't bowed out of the race. And
I think it's going to get dirty before it gets clean. That's all I'm saying. I think that's a nice way. It's a nice way to look last night. But
yeah.
I will.
I hope you're wrong, Monique. I mean, you may well be right, but I hope you're wrong. I think that. There have been some hiccups along the way, frankly. There have been some times when Hillary Clinton has, Barack Obama, you know, she and John McCain have experience and he only has a speech, that kind of thing. It's going to come back to haunt him. And you know, these what I call shots below the belt. But I think that they've been few and far between. And I think that, frankly, they've been the responsibility of Mark Penn. And I think, you know, Mark Penn is history. And so, you know, hopefully... You know, it's possible you're right, but I believe that you're wrong and that we're going to see Hillary Clinton trying to take the high road from here on out. And Barack Obama, of course, by and large, has been holding the high road all along. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour for our second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry Jeffrey is on the line with us. He is the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. And Terry, your guy had a pretty tough night last night. John McCain, on 26% of Republican voters... in North Carolina, voted against John McCain. 22% of Republican voters in Indiana voted against John McCain, and he's already won the nomination.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I looked at the polls, and I saw that Huckabee and Romney were getting some votes there, and Ron Paul.
Boy, were they ever. So what are you going to do? I mean, here in Human Events, Newt Gingrich says... that the Republican Party faces a real disaster on Election Day unless they move immediately to chart a bold course for real reform. At the same time, Bush today comes out and says that the Democrats' approach to dealing with the nation's housing crisis and soaring energy prices is wrong, and wants an extension of his expiring tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and expanded wiretapping authority. You guys really going to run on a campaign of we want to listen into your phone calls, we want to wiretap the Democrats, and by the way, we're going to cut the taxes for millionaires, billionaires, and people who make a living sitting on their butt waiting for the dividend check, and jack up taxes on the average middle class person like Reagan, doubled taxes on working people?
Well, the phone calls they want to listen into are international phone calls that have one leg outside the United States and are placed to or from people who have suspected links to Al-Qaeda.
Then why not have a judge say, yep, that's what you're doing?
Because they can't necessarily get established probable cause in real time to be able to intercept the conversation.
They don't have to. The FISA Act gives you 3 days.
I would say this, though, Tom. If someone can show real harm that they were unjustly wiretapped by the federal government, then they should do so.
Well, the problem is the Bush administration refuses to give that information to Congress or any investigative body, and they refuse to allow the Justice Department to investigate the crime that George Bush has already admitted to. He's already confessed to wiretapping over 15,000 people illegally.
It, 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 It's not a crime. First of all, look, I'm not a champion.
It is a crime under FISA.
I am not a champion of unilateral executive power. I think there's almost no unilateral executive power in the U.S. Constitution except in just that one circumstance, and this is it. If you go back and you look at what the Founding Fathers said at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia when they talked about the war power, they said there's absolutely no way we're going to allow an executive to go to war on its own power. The one thing they did want to leave him was the ability to repel a sudden attack. That is the exact phrase in Madison's notes of the Constitution. You cannot repel a sudden attack against the United States unless you know one is coming, and that does imply to the president the power to engage in espionage or counter-espionage without the approval of the judiciary branch of the federal government.
And I would say internationally, nobody's disputing that. But when calls are coming through the United States, when people in the United States are involved, you have in the United States Senate, you had a Republican operative operating out of Orrin Hatch's office who had cracked into Teddy Kennedy's computer. And for a year and a half, the Democrats couldn't figure out why it was. Every time they went to the floor to debate a federal judge, the Republicans were way ahead of them and had their strategy already figured out. It was because this guy was listening in on, was reading the emails of the Democratic strategy sessions.
Well, there was never
even a serious investigation. Orrin Hatch fired him and apologized, and that was it.
Well,
I mean, this is the kind of thing that Richard Nixon was doing.
First of all, I'm not sure that's what happened. I think he was accessing things that were on an open computer server that the staff of the committee had. But that is different from the President of the United States intercepting international phone calls.
But you don't know, Terry.
Well, Tom, wait a minute.
You don't know because Bush said, you know, first of all, he came out and he said, when we wiretap, we get a warrant. The First Amendment or the Constitution is still intact. He was lying through his teeth. We later learned that he was lying through his teeth and he's wiretapping without warrants and he's wiretapped, we know, at least 15,000 Americans without warrants. We don't know who they are.
Well, no, wait a minute, Tom. There's a long history of this, question being reviewed by U.S. federal appeals courts on the question of whether they can even wiretap people inside the United States, wholly inside the United States, even plant a bug in their home for national security purposes, for espionage. And historically, and I'm talking about recent history, the courts have decided that if the federal government gets criminal evidence of a crime with a warrantless wiretap that was placed in the first place for counter-espionage, national security purposes, that evidence is admissible in court.
So what you're saying, Terry, is that the Republicans, in fact, we're talking with Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, what you're saying is that the Republicans are, in fact, going to run on a platform of more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, higher taxes for average working people, and we're going to, by the way, we're going to wiretap your phone, and nobody can stop us.
Wait a minute. It's the Democrats who do not want to make permanent the Bush tax cuts, which virtually eliminate federal income taxes for families of four making less than $40,000 a year. They want to get rid of a tax cut that's a tax cut for working people, for middle-class people, and, yes, for rich people.
Yeah,
they want to get rid of it.
Yes, and yes, for rich people. That's the big part of it.
For rich people, too. And part of the fact that you cut the marginal tax base for rich people, many of whom are independent business people, is you allow these people to have money that they can invest in creating new jobs.
And it's worked so very well. They have invested that in creating so many new jobs in China, in Mexico, in Vietnam. They're creating new jobs all over the world, everywhere except the United States.
But, you know, Tom, most of those people who are taking money and investing it and creating jobs overseas are corporations. They are not individuals who are filing tax returns as individuals.
Okay, so corporations are paying 7.4%, according to the Berkshire Hathaway annual report. They're paying 7.4% of federal taxes. In the 1950s, they were paying 35% of federal taxes. You think the balance of that isn't coming out of your pocket and mine out of the...
I think you may have a legitimate argument if you say that if Motorola goes to China and builds a manufacturing facility over there instead of building it in the United States, that they ought to pay a tariff to bring the product back into the United States to make up for the difference in the regulation and the taxation they do not have to face in the United States when they...
How about a tariff that balances the cost of labor?
Well, I think that's something that's definitely worth debating. I think if you're going to...
That's how we did it from the founding of this country until Reagan came along.
Well, not until Reagan came along. In fact,
yeah, Reagan began this whole thing of, you know, these most favored nation status and... No, he didn't. Carter, actually. Some of this began under Carter, but it really picked up under Reagan and as a tool to break unions, and it went under steroids under George Herbert Walker Bush.
You know, Reagan actually slapped massive tariffs on Japanese motorcycles to protect and defend Harley-Davidson from...
Yes.
Being driven out of business. That was Ronald Reagan. But look,
I know, and Bush did steal.
If we could roll back the clock and go to the original tax system under the Constitution, the federal government was run by a tariff, which is a consumption tax that was self-limiting, that actually helped develop industry and jobs in the United States of America, I'd be all for it.
Well, good. You know, it's actually, that was the Republican position for a long, long time. It was the Republicans who pushed through Smoot-Hawley. I mean, this is Hoover's thing. Let me just ask you, are you going to condemn Glenn Beck for things like
this? We're talking to Honky Whitesville from the Obama campaign.
And then this guy goes into this whole 15-minute racist thing that's supposed to be funny. It's pathetic. Are you going
to
condemn that?
Well, I have to tell you, I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't comment on it.
Then Fox News, for example, this last night.
Look, I can, Mort couldn't explain it, but I can explain to you why we use the phrase working class. It is a euphemism because it's kind of mean to say lower class. It's as simple as that. That's why we call it working class. Everybody knows who we're talking about. We're talking about, Mort, forget it. We're talking about lower
income,
class, lower income, less education.
You're not talking about social class,
yeah,
are you?
That too.
Yeah, I'm talking lower social class. That too. At the very end, Fox News was saying, hey, we didn't really mean to offend all of our viewers. Class warfare, race warfare, is this all the Republican Party has
offered? Well, I'm not sure I heard that whole clip clearly, but what I think I did understand about it, he's saying that working class equals lower class in the United States. I would contest that. I would say that if you look at it in terms of the relative wealth of people in this world, people who work in the United States of America, anybody who's working in the United States of America, bringing in a steady income in this country, is relatively wealthy on a global scale. If you compare them to people anywhere in the third world.
We've got 2 billion people on the planet living on less than $5 a day.
That's right.
3 billion people on the planet living on less than $15
a
day.
And our economic system and our system of government has allowed for tremendous prosperity for anybody who gets up and goes to work in the morning in this country.
Unless you compare us with Western Europe, with the fully industrialized countries of the world where people actually have health care and free college education.
You know, I respectfully disagree with you on that. I've been all around Western Europe. I've been in the third world. I've seen the way people live around this globe. And I don't think there's any comparison to the way we live in the United States. And there's a lot of things, a lot of capital investment of our ancestors in this country that we enjoy, that we don't have to sink money into ourselves, that make life better here.
Apparently, Terry, you and I have seen the same things and drawn different conclusions. We'll have to, one of these days, have a conversation about that. But
sure.
I appreciate you dropping by. Terry Jeffrey, he is the editor at CNSNews.com. Thanks, Terry. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Karl Rove, who is an advisor to the McCain campaign, has actually been quoted in the Washington Post and identified as a, quote, informal McCain advisor. It's been 91 days that Rove has been on Fox News. 91 days, the watch going on, and no identification of Rove as a McCain advisor. Something really, really, really bad here. Tony Zirkel, the Republican candidate, this is from thinkprogress.org, the Republican candidate for Indiana's 2nd Congressional District, was soundly defeated in yesterday's primary election, coming in a distant last. He's the guy who recently delivered a speech to the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party, on the 119th anniversary of Adolf Hitler's birthday. Well, I guess that's, you know, good news. Republicans aren't quite as crazy as we thought. Well, hard to say. And the Joint Chiefs Chairman Mullen, the military is ready to accept a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's good news. That's, you know, there's a whole lot of, you know, good starting points here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Janine in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Janine, what's up?
Tom, I just wanted to tell you about a call that I got last night. It was kind of like one of a, like a robocall deal, but it was from Representative John Shattuck. And it said that, you know, if you'd like to ask him a question, you know, press zero and we'll get you in the queue. So I did. I waited. And I asked him about the FISA Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he went on. He said, well, for those of you who don't know what it is, you know, he went on and explained. And he emphasized, you know, the word foreign. And then I said, okay, that being said, if they're not doing anything illegal, then why do we need to grant immunity to the telecoms?
Right.
His response was, and I don't know how many of the people were on the phone listening, it was purely a financial reason so that nobody can tie up the telecoms in needless lawsuits, which they are still going to have to pay for, you know, whether they go on for 6 months, 1 year, or 6 years. It's still going to cost them attorney's fees, even when in the end, you know, it'll come out that they didn't do anything wrong. So it was purely, he maintains it's purely a financial.
So in other words, these giant corporations who have hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue shouldn't have to spend a couple $100,000 or even a couple $1 million in lawyers' fees to defend their illegal actions when their own lawyers could have told them, and in fact, in the case of Quest, their lawyers did tell them,
yeah,
this is illegal, and Quest said, no, we're not going to do it.
Right. So
in other words, your member of Congress said that he's not in favor of corporations being held responsible for criminal acts.
Absolutely. He made that extremely clear.
This guy's a Republican?
Yes.
What's his name again?
John Shattuck. S-H-A-D-E-G-G.
And he represents Phoenix or part of Phoenix?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. So he's on the record as saying corporations should not be held accountable if they commit criminal acts.
Right, because they would be needless lawsuits, and they should not have to pay the attorney's fees and the costs of a lawsuit, even though they would be vindicated in the end.
That's absolutely incredible.
That is the only absolute reason other than that.
Yeah.
And
plus the campaign contributions that they're probably giving him. I mean,
exactly.
Janine, thank you.
I asked him about the 3-day deal, you know, the 72-hour thing, and he said, you know, no, you know, that's your constitutional right when you know, in country. But he kept going on about the wireless thing,
yeah,
the calls coming in from other countries, the terrorists calling, and so that's what they're projecting.
Yeah, no, I have heard it. Janine, thank you very much for the call. And, of course, Bush originally was saying...
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. It's important for our fellow citizens to understand, when you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place when it comes to doing what is necessary to protect our homeland because we value the Constitution.
But then after he got caught red-handed...
There's a process that goes on inside the Justice Department and I presume about leaks. I presume that process is moving forward.
In other words, he's going after the people who outed him.
My personal opinion is it was a shameful act.
To out him.
For someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
This illegal program in time of war.
The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy.
Yeah.
You got to understand, and I hope the American people understand, there is still an enemy that would like to strike the United States of America, and they're very dangerous.
Yeah, in other words, as he said before the Republican National Committee...
be afraid. September the 11th, we saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doom, killers.
Yeah, we'll be taking more of your calls right after this. In the next hour, how to disappear in America. And tomorrow, Governor Don Siegelman will be taking your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. It's all right.
Back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for change in Washington, D.C. You can find out more about it over at teamsters.org. So George W. Bush saying, well, you know, we can violate that Fourth Amendment that people says that says the people should be secure in their home, their property, against government intrusion, except by, well, let's actually check out the actual original language of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, just to be totally specific about it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. This, it says the people, by the way. It doesn't say citizens of the United States. There are places where the Constitution differentiates. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, the only way that you can actually get into somebody's phone conversations, email, home, person, papers, things like that, is if somebody swears before a judge, hey, there's probable cause a crime is being committed, and the judge says, okay, fine, I'm going to issue a warrant. George Bush, as soon as it was discovered that he was illegally wiretapping Americans, illegally listening in on our conversations, illegally probably listening in on the Democratic Party's strategy sessions, he says,
quick to detect and prevent. We use FISA still. You're referring to the FISA court in your question. Of course we use FISA. But Pfizer's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect.
Yeah.
Having suggested this idea, I then obviously went to the question, is it legal to do so?
Obviously, yes.
I swore to uphold the laws.
Yeah.
Do I have the legal authority to do this?
No, you don't.
And the answer is absolutely.
The answer from who?
As I mentioned in my remarks, the legal authority is derived from the Constitution.
Yeah.
As well as the authorization of force by the United States Congress.
Oh, yeah, that authorization of force document, that one that said, yes, go ahead and wiretap people. No, it didn't. Again, lying through his teeth. This, and the larger frame here, what does it mean to be an American? What are the ideals that we hold in this country? Hillary Clinton, in one of her most shining moments, gave a talk about this issue. And Al Gore is speaking to it yesterday. I'm going to play that clip in just a moment. First, I want to share with you Hillary Clinton talking to this issue on the floor of the United States Senate.
When General Washington led his soldiers across the Delaware River and onto victory in the Battle of Trenton, he captured nearly 1,000 foreign mercenaries, and he faced a crucial choice.
Now, these were mercenaries hired by the British. They weren't even the British. I mean, you want to talk about enemy combatants.
How would General Washington treat these prisoners? The British had already committed atrocities against Americans, including torture.
Including torture of some of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence.
As David Hackett Fisher describes in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Washington's Crossing, thousands of American prisoners of war were treated with extreme cruelty by British captors. There are accounts of injured soldiers who surrendered being murdered instead of quartered.
In fact, it was not unusual that the British treated our soldiers with extreme brutality and simply murdered them rather than having to feed them.
Countless Americans dying in prison hulks in New York Harbor. Starvation and other acts of inhumanity perpetrated against Americans confined to churches in New York City. Well, you can imagine the light of our ideals shone dimly in those early dark days, years from an end to the conflict, years before our improbable triumph and the birth of our democracy.
And so George Washington, with 1,000 mercenary troops, enemy combatants, not even the soldiers of the foreign army, what will he do with them? He is establishing the precedent and defining what it means to be an American.
General Washington announced a decision unique in human history, sending the following order for handling prisoners. Treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. George Washington understood that how you treat enemy combatants can reverberate around the world. We must convict and punish the guilty in a way that reinforces their guilt before the world and does not undermine our values.
Amen. As Bill Clinton did with Tim McVeigh, and as George Bush did not do with Osama bin Laden. Al Gore weighing in on this yesterday.
Ultimately, the guarantor of our freedoms are the people. And these kinds of outrages, a president saying that he has the right to overturn George Washington's 200-plus year prohibition against torture and torture anyone he wants, with his assistants gathered in the basement of the White House, according to recent revelations, personally reviewing the kinds of torture techniques being used prisoner by prisoner. It's obscene.
It's obscene. Obscene is the perfect word. Al Gore, tip of the hat to you. You know, well said. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark, listening on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Love your show.
Thank you.
I just thought maybe you're not doing Bush quite enough credit. I don't think he wants to do this illegal phone tapping on American citizens either. And I think that's why he wants us to all not have a home. If you don't have a home, you don't have a phone, and, you know, there's nothing to tap.
Right. The ultimate goal, well, actually, you know, there's a sad and tragic irony to this. Alan Greenspan pointed out, and it was in the Wall Street Journal back in 1996 or 7, I quote him in my book Screwed. Alan Greenspan pointed out that he viewed his job as chairman of the Fed to increase interest rates, to slow down the economy whenever the economy got good enough that workers started agitating for wages, for better wages, or for unionization. He said, and this is the quote from Greenspan, he said that it was his job to maintain a, quote, certain minimum level of worker insecurity in the marketplace, end quote. And you know, I mean, the Republican agenda is quite clear. Keep people terrified, keep them poor, and you will have power over them.
One of the things I've never understood, when you look through the Constitution, parts of it are so broadly interpreted and other parts so narrowly. It's true that the Fourth Amendment doesn't say anything about security in your data. But, you know, we didn't talk about digital data back then.
Says your papers, and I think your papers and your data are the same thing. I mean, they understood that even the U.S. mail back then was considered sacred.
It's not now, and I don't understand.
Yeah. No, I'll tell you what it is. It's Republican policies. It's these guys who just do not believe in fundamentally anti-American. It's just that simple. They're fundamentally anti-American. Consider why Bush went to war, for example. You know, Mickey Herskowitz was hired by George and Barbara Bush, George Sr. and Barbara Bush, to write the autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which you can find in the bookstores today, for George W. Bush, to write his autobiography. And Mickey Herskowitz wrote the first draft. And as Cindy Sheehan testified before Congress, under oath, before John Conyers' commission, and she was simply quoting news reports, here's the, you know, why we actually went to war.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz.
Now keep in mind, this was 1999. This was before Bush had even announced he was running for president.
Then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief."
This is Bush, in his own words.
My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
There you go. So, you know, why did we attack Iraq? So that George W. Bush, I'd go back to the 2002 election, so that Bush could regain control of the Senate after Jim Jeffords flipped it in 2002, and he did, so that he could get himself reelected in 2004, and he got it close enough that he could steal it in Ohio, that in 2006 the Republicans could still use the be afraid, be very afraid.
Be afraid, yeah. September the 11th. We saw terror. Tragedy around
terror
is on
coming.
A quiet
terror,
morning.
Terror, terror, terror. That he could continue to use that. And he did.
Dick Cheney, they're going to hit us again if you elect the Democrats.
Yeah. I think the American people are waking up. Joel in Orange County. Hey, Joel, about a minute before we got to take a break here. What's up?
Okay, I'll try to be very quick, and maybe you can let me get on afterwards. I just had some pointers. First of all, I think in the aftermath of yesterday's critical primaries, you know, the focus should be on what's going forward with the Democratic presidential campaign. If you just heard... Hillary Clinton's press conference just a few minutes ago, she emphasized that she's still going forward in the rest of the primaries. She's going after Michigan and Florida. She wants those delegates seated, and she said specifically in accordance with the votes that were taken. I think it's very clear that the Clintons have not, despite some statements in her speech last night, they haven't given up their strategy. And I think it's really up now to the superdelegates.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, they're definitely not going to give up. I mean, it would be, frankly, I think it would be a mistake. And I think it's a fine thing that Hillary Clinton is going to continue in this race, at least through May 20th, through the Oregon primary. It's bringing people out. It's getting people activized. Activists. It's energized, excuse me, is the word I was. It's getting people out there and getting them voting. This is an extraordinary time for Democrats in America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program.
Tall trees, white snow, will they be here when I go?
Minutes before the hour,
Nolan Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, calling in from the Middle East. Ellen, first of all, welcome. I want to ask you about something that Michael Ledeen and John Bolton are talking about here. Are you there?
I am here. I'm listening.
Okay, great. Yesterday on Fox News, John Bolton announced that the use of military force against Iranian training camps is really the most prudent thing to do. And then
we certainly heard about that over here.
Right. And then Michael Ledeen of the American Enterprise Institute said Bolton is right. He's been proposing this for years. Ledeen said we should also do the same thing with Syria. So what's the word on the street you're in Dubai?
We had heard from one of our sources that there were, in fact, more than, and I might have said this to you yesterday, that there were more than two ships in, big ships in the Gulf between, or in the water between, Emirates and Oman and of course Iran. Hmm. So, as you know, Meredith McKenzie is at the Pentagon full time for us, so I had her ask about that this morning.
Hmm.
And the Pentagon has completely denied that there are any more ships there.
Okay.
But that does not mean they're not there.
Yeah. So
because we had heard from the grapevine here that there were more ships there.
Yeah. is, and there's a fair amount, I'm guessing, of anxiety among people.
Oh,
in the
people
Middle
would not be happy, and it would really, I mean, that would completely destabilize this area for sure.
Yeah, not that it's not already a mess as a consequence of.
Well, yes, but you know, Dubai and Oman are pretty. And Bahrain, and those three are pretty stable and as you know, a pretty heavy-duty market economy. In fact, I think Microsoft moved their Middle East office, or their main headquarters, I should say, from UAE up to Bahrain. So this area is considered, as you know, the financial sort of breadbasket of the region.
Right.
And people would not be happy, but there is certainly some word on the street about that.
Yeah. So what's happening around the world and in Washington, D.C.?
Well, in Washington, D.C., there were two conference calls this morning, one by Obama and one by Hillary Clinton. As you know, Hillary Clinton's loan to her campaign is now about $11 million.
Right.
And they said that she was going to be strong in West Virginia, and they're not going away.
Right. She just held a news conference, actually, saying that, basically. And she probably will do very well in West Virginia and in Kentucky.
Right. The Obama campaign just did a conference call, and they had on it John Kerry and Senator Klobuchar and Senator McCaskill and also Janet, Governors Napolitano and Deval Patrick, and Kerry basically said that he thought that last night's victories were giant and decisive, and that they believe the time is for superdelegates to begin this process to a close, to announce who they're supporting, and to get moving, basically.
Well, George McGovern, who was a big supporter of Hillary Clinton, just came out.
He just called President Clinton today on that.
Right, and asked and suggested that Hillary should get out. My personal take on it is that it would be unwise, other than possibly for financial reasons, and that may ultimately be the bottom line for her, but, you know, she has a fair amount of cash. It would be unwise for her to get out before the May 20th primaries, because she's going to pick up two primaries between now and then, and Obama's going to pick up Oregon in all probability, and that would be she could run it all the way to the end of, you know, the first week of June, but that would be an appropriate time for her to say, okay, you know, we fought the good fight, but at this point it's obvious how this thing is going to end.
Except for the fact that I would look at my $50 million or $51 million or whatever she has left after paying taxes and everything, and I'd say I'm certainly not going to spend 10 or 11 million bucks on it. I don't know. That would just be me, but I'm not running for president.
Well, the longer she stays in the race, is that going to be the more money she'll be spending or the more opportunity she'll have for fundraising?
Well, obviously she's going to have some opportunity for fundraising, but, I mean, she's going to have to do a lot of, if she doesn't get the nomination, she's going to have to do a lot of fundraisers to make up that $11 million.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that she's in debt right now indicates that apparently she's, although you could argue that, you know, she just dumped an enormous amount of money in North Carolina and Indiana going for broke, and now if she just kind of coasts, maybe she can raise more than she's spending and she can pay down some of that debt.
Perhaps. I wanted to inform you about two other quick things here.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, and this is going to be very interesting, Senator Lieberman and Susan Collins from the Homeland Security on the Senate Committee are going to be releasing a report called Violent Islamist Extremism, the Internet and the Homegrown Terrorist Threat. So this is going to be a little more saber-rattling, I think.
Oh, my. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Exactly. And the Secretary General, as you know, we have Dan Patterson at the United Nations today, and he has he's very concerned about the bombing that just took place in Darfur, and they're trying to get UN people in there. And, of course, as you know, UN convoys have been attacked in Darfur. So he has issued a statement about that and also issued a statement about the what's going on in Myanmar, Burma,
yeah.
And the fact today that came up at the press briefing, and Dana Perino said that, in fact, they have not let in any American, they haven't let in people The government is letting in aid, but not people.
So Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has condemned the bombings in Darfur?
Explicitly. Very much so.
That's great.
Very strongly. You know,
do you expect there to be any U.N. action on this? Or is China going
to
block
it? They would like to make it safe action. You know, they have trouble even getting their supplies in.
Yeah, okay. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman,
your radio support group for We the People. Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
Just a quick reminder, tomorrow Governor Don Siegelman will be with us, and we'll give you an opportunity to ask him the questions that are on your mind. He has said that he will take our listeners' calls. This should be a very, very interesting time. You know, sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you do know. Sometimes even...
you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible the Firesign Theater is right? Well, most of us thought it was impossible to disappear in America, or if we did, it was illegal. Barry Reed is here to disabuse us of that notion. Published by Eden Press. In fact, he's the publisher of Eden Press for 35 years. And the author of alternative books on privacy, new identity, and over at EdenPress.com, now the new book, How to Disappear in America. Barry Reed, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
So, first of all, it is not illegal to disappear. Tell us about this.
Well, it certainly isn't. You're free to walk down the road, never look back. Obviously, there are people have obligations, but if you want to... disappear from friends and so forth, that's up to you. It certainly isn't illegal. There's no crime about that.
So in this day and age of computer chips that will give away the location of your cell phone, Real ID Act, putting RFID chips in our driver's licenses, there are already RFID chips in our passports. How does, and certainly, you know, any billing, any charge, any kind of economic activity at all going into huge central databases, which are being shared not just between companies, but with our government as well. How is it possible to disappear in America?
Well, you've got to quit using these things. You've got to, you know, quit using banks. You certainly can quit using credit cards. Basically, you have to go back to being a person. And you don't, and most of these, you mentioned RFIDs, in documents and so forth, they're not used for tracking. They're just read-only, and they don't track people in stores or anything like that, at least not yet. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, you raised an awful lot of points in your introduction there, but basically people can become as private as they wish. They just have to watch what they do and what they say, and that's the problem with most Americans. They talk too much.
Yeah. Well, why would somebody want to disappear?
Well, two basic reasons. The first would be simply privacy. They just don't want to be bothered. And secondly, and maybe more basic, for security. They just don't want people imposing on their lives.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people basically do disappear, and you don't think about it. But many, many celebrities, for example, basically are invisible. You can't get to them.
Yeah, but that's because they have layers and walls of... protective, you know, they put all their stuff in corporations.
That's perfectly legal, and you're not going to walk off the street and find these people either. So individuals can do the very same thing. They just have to know how to go about it.
So this doesn't require becoming a homeless person?
Well, no. No, in fact, you could reestablish yourself quite well in another community and, in a sense, be unknown, even invisible, and untraceable.
How do you get a job if you don't use your same name and your same Social Security number?
Well, hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens get jobs.
So you're talking about operating in an underground economy. That is illegal, is it not?
I'm being facetious.
Okay.
Obviously, you can make money without having a job, or depending on an employer, you can be self-employed, and you can also work for people on the side or temporarily and make money. It is not impossible to do that, and our book shows lots of examples
Although, isn't that technically illegal to be paid under the table, essentially?
You might consider some of these things gray or you know, yes or no type situations, but they can be temporary, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some people have probationary periods in employment, maybe you know as much as 3 months, perhaps, and they have that time to adjust or perhaps move on. But there are also a lot of opportunities that are just pickup opportunities. You can make cash that way.
Right. How many people do you think, we're talking with Barry Reed, by the way. He's the publisher of Eden Press. EdenPress.com is the website. A whole series of books, actually, over there on privacy. And his new one is called How to Disappear in America. Barry, how many people do you think in the United States? We have a little over 300 million people, over 115 million people who are, you know, wage earners, as it were. How many people are, setting aside people who are in this country without citizenship, setting that whole cohort aside, which, you know, it's a, depending on whose numbers you're using, a substantial number of people, but setting them aside, how many Americans have chosen to disappear, in your opinion?
Okay, well, I wouldn't have really an exact number for you, but I can give you one concept. The FBI admits, for example, that at any one time, anywhere from 20 to 30,000 people are considered missing. And that's not to say that they're actually looking for them. They're just people who have been reported not around.
Are many of these people who have been murdered?
Well, again, you have to look at it in from different perspectives. These are people that are reported missing, but they've not been found. Now, that means, you know, dead or alive, I don't know. Most of them would have to be considered that they're still living and around. They just choose not to be found.
Right.
And there's lots of them, and I've been doing this since 1971, and I've gotten many, many letters over the years from people who are basically, it's not that they're on the run, they don't want to be found.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember, people with the, for example, the Weather Underground, you know, Bernadette Dorn went under, you know, Bill Ayers vanished for a while. There's a few of them who just,
went for years. In fact, that lady,
Linda Evans.
Yeah, I believe so. Yes. She was, here in California. Well, in prison, I guess. And she got out, then they put her right back in again. But that's kind of an extreme example. She lived for years as another person. I can give you a really great example. One maybe some of your listeners will recall is Abby Hoffman from the 40 years ago in the Democratic Convention riots in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was busted a few years after that and went underground. It was a kind of a bogus drug thing in New York City. And he definitely went underground and was never, in fact, found. Ostensibly, he did a few plastic surgery things, but he stayed in touch with me, and I always knew it was him because of his signature and his writing. He had a very distinctive handwriting style.
Mm-hmm.
And he even ran for public office somewhere in New England. And I want to tell you that the name he used publicly as his name underground was Barry Freed, which was a play on my name.
Right. Now, Abby Hoffman actually, in the end, allegedly committed suicide at a time that he was writing, as I recall, an exposé of George W. Bush, was it not? Or there was an exposé of some...
It couldn't have been George W. Bush. I mean, I believe he died in the early 90s or late 80s. I'm not
okay, but he was writing some big exposé for Playboy magazine that the Republican Party was very upset about. That's my recollection.
I can't argue with that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that he lived successfully underground and was never, in fact, found.
Never, until he died?
No, never. Absolutely never. I mean, that's not to say he didn't have a support group. He had friends here and there, and they definitely helped take care of him, but the FBI didn't find him.
But but he may have been doing that illegally. I mean, he may have come up with a phony idea, Social Security number and all that sort of thing.
Well, I would assume that he did.
Yeah, so how does one do it legally? Because that's the essence of your book, How to Disappear in America.
Of course.
What's the first step to disappearing legally?
Well, you have to think about what you're trying to accomplish. If you're going to go just short term, you may not need to do anything. You just need to physically remove yourself from a situation or a place. If you're going to go long term, and I break this down in the book, you'll definitely want to consider getting another Social Security number, and there are definitely ways to do that. It's not illegal to get another Social Security number, and the law even provides ways for getting it. And I have this in detail in the book. When the original Social Security law was passed in the 30s, the unions were very upset about employers maintaining files on presumed troublemakers and activists and so forth, and they got written into the law that the number was never to be used for any kind of file system, which, of course, it was perverted later on to become one.
Right.
But that's not to say the original intent of the law is right there, and it's still on the books. And you can definitely get another number if you feel that you are being disadvantaged or things are being worked against you to your disadvantage, particularly in regarding employment. So people just have to be aware.
But then you're disappearing from everybody except the federal government, right?
Well, you're not required to have a Social Security number. You can live without one if you want. You'll just never get retirement benefits.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to beat these things to death.
Sure.
But,
and changing your name?
The government doesn't own us, you know. We're supposed to be on our own.
Well, that's the theory. That's the theory. But it seems like the practical reality is that to some extent the government does own us, and to a larger extent the corporations own us, you know, everything from your credit rating to everything else.
Yes.
And you're telling folks how to get around that. I just find the whole thing fascinating. EdenPress.com, the website, for more information about it. Barry Reed, the publisher and author of How to Disappear in America. Barry, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Okay, great. Thanks. Good talking to you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
The hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Well, should Hillary pull out now, or should she continue to fight on? If she's going to fight on, if she's going to continue in this primary, should she take on Barack Obama even more aggressively, or should she try to achieve some sort of reconciliation? Is she going after the vice presidential position, or is she simply trying to establish, or is she going for president? If so, if she's going for president, is the main strategy, let's just wait for a while and hope that this guy falls over? Let's keep in mind that there was a time when Gary Hart was way out ahead, and he self-destructed with the Donna Rice affair. There was a time when Bobby Kennedy was way out ahead. He was assassinated. God forbid such a thing should happen. But the fact of the matter is that there have been a number of times in the history of the Democratic Party, and presumably the Republican Party as well, When there was a presumptive front runner, everybody thought that person had it. You know, Ed Muskie was way out ahead. Everybody thought Ed Muskie was going to be the guy. And, you know, Richard Nixon sends Charlie Colson and his buddies out there, and the allegation is somebody put some drugs in Muskie's coffee, and Muskie gets up on, and obviously somebody broke into his offices and stole some of his letterhead and wrote this a letter using a racial slur, Canuck, to insult French Canadians, that was published in the front page of the Manchester Union Leader, the statewide right-wing newspaper in New Hampshire. And Muskie got up on the back of the flatbed truck and started defending his wife and broke into tears. And that was the end of his campaign. I mean, is the strategy that Hillary is pursuing to simply wait it out and see if Obama implodes? Does she, you know, what's the end game here? I don't, personally, my guess is, particularly given that last night she lost North Carolina by such a large margin, and the win in Indiana was such a small margin, that when you add in the Limbaugh factor, it looks like she probably really lost both states, and perhaps significantly. My guess is that she's going to play this out for at least a couple more weeks in order to have wins in West Virginia and Kentucky, and just... And Obama will take Oregon, and May 20th, or maybe the first week of June, you know, I mean, it's just a couple weeks later, just run the thing to the end and say, you know, damn it, I did my best. I put in a good fight, and if by that time Obama has not imploded, if there hasn't been some Reverend Wright on steroids revelation come out, then she gets out of the way and she becomes a big supporter of his, and as she has said a couple of times she will do, she becomes the person who is campaigning for him, and Bill Clinton as well. And, you know, what a great team to have campaigning for you. And my personal guess is that she would not be interested in being vice president, but that she would love to be replacing Harry Reid as the leader of the Senate. And frankly, I'd love to have her replace Harry Reid as the leader of the Senate. I think that that we need somebody as the leader of the Senate who is a fighter. And Hillary Clinton has demonstrated that she is a fighter. Boy, is she a fighter. And so assuming that this thing plays out the direction that it certainly looks it's going to be playing out, I think that would be a really fascinating take on the whole thing. Don in Sausalito, listening on Green 960 in San Francisco. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Happy birthday from my houseboat here in Sausalito.
Well, thank you to our houseboat here in Portland, Oregon.
Well, I was 68 last Monday.
Oh, my.
Hello, Taurus.
Well, thank you. You've got a little more than a decade on me, but
glad
to have you.
Yeah, well, I'm still working on it. getting younger, I mean.
There you go.
A couple of things. Is there a way to reframe Obama as half-white?
Well, that's, actually, up until the Reverend Wright controversy broke, I think the majority of Americans who were aware of him politically, which would be most Democrats who were looking at this thing, knew mostly about his biography. And if you look at the ads that he ran, they showed photos of his white mother, his white grandmother, his growing up. I mean, he basically grew up in a white community, by and large, in small town Kansas and in Hawaii. And they showed that as, here's the guy who's half white. And his father's been gone since he was 2 years old. The Reverend Wright affair, to the extent that it's been used by the media and in some ways was used by the Clinton campaign, was, I think, an attempt to make him more black. The original question was, is he black enough? And then, so the answer from his opponents came, we'll make him even blacker. My guess is that as we go into the general election, it'll be back to pointing out that this guy is half white and half black. The thing that he doesn't share that Michelle does, his wife does, is the DNA of slavery. He doesn't have slavery in his genes. His father came from Kenya. And, I think that was the thing that early on for many African Americans was causing them to say, this guy's not quite one of us because he hasn't had his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents telling him the stories of what it was like back in the day. Whereas his wife had that experience. But I'd say, he's been out there in the political world long enough. He was an organizer in Chicago. He knows what the black experience is in America. I mean, he gets it. He's been there. He's done that. I don't think that there's anybody in America who would question Barack Obama's understanding of what the black community has gone through. And the challenge that he has now, post-Reverend Wright, is convincing whites in America that he understands what the white community has gone through. Under Reagan, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. 4 minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, tomorrow, Governor Don Siegelman is going to be back on the program after a couple of weeks. We'll get an update on what's going on with his case and how long it's going to be before Karl Rove gets frog-marched out of Texas in chains. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dennis in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dennis, you're a Republican and you want to comment on Barack Obama?
Well, I'm a Operation Payoff Commando here in Eugene. Actually, I'll be voting for Hillary to keep her in the race. But
an Operation Chaos Commander.
Commando.
Commando. Oh, interesting. So you're a genuine ditto head.
Oh, you bet. Of course.
So why, given that by, let's assume for a moment that Russia's actually had the influence on this race of extending the battle between Hillary and Obama. It has led to, I mean, Louise and I spent part of this weekend with Bill Bradbury, our Secretary of State here in Oregon, and absolutely record registrations of people as Democrats in this state, and we have closed primaries in this state. These are not people who are just participating for the purposes of trying to, you know, vote for Hillary and then get out. I mean, there's probably a few folks like you, but I think the minority, you know, you're absolutely in the minority. So aren't you guys shooting yourself in the foot?
Well, I think that's wishful thinking. I think they'll all be switching back now that when the primaries are over. Everybody will, at least I will, of course, and I think more than you want to admit will. Because,
isn't it fundamentally un-American? I mean, isn't it fundamentally wrong to try to mess with an electoral system that has to do with trying to select the best person for this country?
No, of course not. The press and the Democrats gave us John McCain. You know, we didn't want him. He's not the candidate we wanted.
I would say Republicans chose John McCain.
The New York Times, guess who they endorsed? They endorsed John McCain, but you think they're going to endorse him in the general election? Of course not. So, in effect, they gave us our candidate.
So, well, you know, I just I don't have a response to that. My best take on it is that the Republican Party just has a shortage of decent candidates. The only guy that you've got who has actually got any fire and enthusiasm out there is Ron Paul. I mean, I remember that I was in New Hampshire for the New Hampshire primaries, and just walking down the street, there were Ron Paul people everywhere, and they were volunteers. He wasn't paying for them. There were, you know, the Mitt Romney people when I was at CPAC. The Mitt Romney people were obviously being paid for what they were doing. You know, there was basically no Republican candidates of any consequence.
We don't have a true conservative in this race, and if we did, they would win in a landslide. Mitt Romney
would
win in a landslide.
So, but you've got, you know, John McCain is parroting all of the, he's flip-flopped on all the issues now. He's now against the immigration bill that he was for before. He's now against abortion that he was in favor of before. He's the woman's right to choose abortion. He's now you just go on down the list. John McCain is basically flip-flopping all these issues. He's now going to appoint Scalia-type judges, when he wasn't in favor of Robertson before. He's turned into the right-winger that you want. Why, you know, can't you guys just win fair and square and say, hey, he's our guy?
Let me lay it out for you. Here's what I want to talk to you about is that, you know, I think everybody knows in the Democratic Party now that Barack Obama is not going to get the white vote. And without the white vote, you're not going to win the presidential election.
Except for the fact that Barack Obama has won the white vote in
Reverend Wright saw to that.
In a wide variety of states. I don't think so.
For a racist.
I don't think so. I don't think so. There's a lot of white folks who voted for Barack Obama.
Did you see the election returns in North Carolina? He lost the white vote 67-33.
It doesn't mean he lost the vote. It means that Hillary Clinton got the vote. Hillary Clinton has been campaigning basically as the gutsy little guy populist, and that appeals to a lot of white working class people. That doesn't mean that they're racists. That doesn't mean that they're not going to vote for Barack Obama simply because his father was black. That means that at that moment they were choosing Hillary Clinton.
No, we realize now that he thinks exactly like Reverend Wright, and he's a racist, and his wife has proved
it. Oh, come on. You know that that's... Dennis, you know... Come on, Dennis. Let's be honest here. You know that that's not true.
Well, and another thing. I mean, 90%...
I mean, you know that that's not true, don't you, Dennis?
Obama. Wouldn't you call
Dennis, you know that that's not true, that you're just reciting something that you think is going to be some kind of a talking point that's going to hurt this guy. Americans aren't buying it this time. We're not. Americans are not buying the whole Republican fear machine. It ain't going to happen.
That's wishful thinking.
Down in Mississippi, you had a Republican who was running, and he was running ads saying that look out for that Democrat. He's in bed with Barack Obama, and they showed pictures of Reverend Wright. And guess what? The Republican lost, and the Democrat won.
And, you know, and the other thing is, ever since Obama has shown that he wants to use the tax code as punishment and as fairdom instead of increasing the coffers coming into the United States, I think he's shown his true colors. You know, when he was asked about the capital gains, and he said, well, you know, it's been proven that if you lower the capital gains, you actually get more money comes from the government. He said, well, I don't care. It's not a fair thing. It's not a fairness thing.
But it's not. And, Dennis, the fact of the matter is that when you lower capital gains, yeah, in that year, you are going to see an increase in revenue. I've done it myself. You sell your stock or you sell the business that you own.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, why not? And is that a good thing for America that small businessmen are bailing out and selling their companies to larger corporations like I did back in 1986? Is it a good thing for America? And then when you average it over a 2 or 3 year period, you find that raising or lowering the capital gains tax has no effect whatsoever other than reducing the capital gains tax. Are you trying to tell me, Dennis, that you think that if I make my living by sitting on my butt on the back of my houseboat watching the geese go by, buying and selling stock and living off dividends, that I should pay a maximum 15% income tax while you, I'm assuming as a working person in the United States here in Eugene, Oregon, that you should pay 36% income tax? Do you think that's right?
So you admit it's more about spreading the misery rather than money into the government.
I think it's about you and I are both users of all the wonderful things that this country has to offer, from free public education to our roads to clean air and water to our national forests right across the board. We use these things. We have an obligation to pay for them. Why should a person who makes their living, and in many cases a much bigger living than either you or I are making, I'm quite sure, Dennis, although I don't know how much you make, but you can tell us if you want, but odds are, why should somebody who's making a whole lot more than either one of us for a living pay a maximum 15% income tax, and we have to pay a maximum of 36%?
Because
tell me why.
Because we want them to keep their incentive to open businesses, invent things, and hire people. And when will the liberals ever get it straight that once you penalize these people and take away their incentive, you know, everybody that calls your show, all they're thinking about is, I want free health care.
Dennis, what you're seeing, tell me a time in the United States when business growth was inhibited by a capital gains tax being the same as the income tax. There is none. Go back in the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s, you had the highest rate of growth of small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and frankly even large businesses in the history of this country. And capital gains and ordinary income were taxed at the same rate. When we started dropping the capital gains tax, what happened was the rich got richer, corporations started making more money, but they didn't actually increase corporate activity. Actually, during the last 7 years, you've seen a decrease in corporate activity.
That's fine with me. I want to live in a country where it's still okay to be rich, and that's still, you know, that you're not going to be penalized.
It's always been fine to be rich, Dennis. It's not a matter of being penalized. It's a matter of paying your fair share.
It's you know, they want to penalize you, and they want to take it away. And
how much are you worth, Dennis?
Misery. That's what the whole Democratic Party is about.
How much are you worth, Dennis?
I'm worth a couple $1 million.
Okay.
I'm retired.
And so you're what, upper middle class, I would say?
I'm upper middle class. Got a couple, I still have a company. My son runs now, but we have about 35 employees. And, you know, I wouldn't hang around and hire these employees if you tax me where I can't make a profit.
So you've got 35 people who were paid, who were educated by using tax dollars. You have a business that is using the infrastructure of this country. You use your court system to enforce contracts. You're using public transport, you know, the availability of roads and things for people. And you don't think you should pay for it?
I do think we should. But do you think that I use any more than the person that's on welfare?
Yeah.
I don't. We both use the same portion of the street.
So you, with your 35 employees, are not using any more of the public education system, for example, than somebody who is, you know, has just a job. Seems to me like you're using at least 35 times as much as the average person.
Well, you know, you're talking about individuals. What I really call to talk about is the Democratic Party knows, they know now, that Barack Obama is damaged. He cannot win. But they better change and put Hillary in there, so because she actually would have a chance to win. But they won't do that because there's going to be riots
Then why are you joining Limbaugh to vote for Hillary if you think that she's actually the strongest Democratic candidate?
I want them bloodied and broke and completely destroyed by each other before the general election.
But it's not happening.
Yes, it is happening.
What's your biggest fear about Obama, Dennis?
It's total liberalism, and every problem the country has is caused by liberalism. Every problem, that's what we have. The only thing we have to fear is liberalism and liberal ideas.
For example?
For example, the war on poverty. It's worse today than after we've spent $8 trillion on it. It's worse today, according to you. Listen to you. It's worse today than it's ever been.
Yeah, Bill Clinton reversed most of the war on poverty. Pretty much most of it just doesn't exist any longer.
I mean, the liberals have destroyed
people get sick, people get divorced, people get thrown out of their, you know, they lose their job. They're screwed by and large in America now.
Why do blacks love Democrats? They've actually destroyed them time after time after time with the welfare programs. They drove the men out of the house.
Yeah. Dennis, I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's fascinating. So you fear liberals. Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's nice to be so scary.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who stand the gun to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
9.5 minutes past the hour, or before the hour, rather. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program powered in part by Teamsters for Change. Time for a change in Washington. You can find out more at teamster.org. Dave in Michigan on WDTW. Hey, Dave, quick comment here about our last caller and Rush Limbaugh's tactics.
Wow, Tom, what great radio. I've heard two exchanges today, one with Jeff and the one with this last caller. And it's amazing how intelligent people, what they'll say to defend their ideology being totally wrong. This last caller was proud of the fact that he sabotaged the part of our election process, and it's just a shame. It's shameful. It's un-American. We've got soldiers, troops overseas, supposedly spreading democracy, and this is our example of democracy, to sabotage elections for un-American reasons, to defend the party. That's not American what these people are doing. That's not what they're, even, it may be technically legal, but it's certainly, it's shameful.
Yeah, I agree.
One quick comment, Tom. Yeah. That was an intelligent caller, and one thing he said was true. He sure is a ditto head. This guy, there is a danger.
I got it. And Dave, I got to move along, but you know, he's spot on. And his final point, by the way, and I really didn't have time to rebut to it. He says, "Oh, his Democrat policies have destroyed African American families with welfare programs." What has destroyed African-American families is not welfare programs. It's racism in the United States and unemployment. As unemployment has run across the United States, the people at the bottom end of the economic ladder, and that's been African-Americans for a long, long time, as a consequence of institutional racism in the United States, are the first ones who get whacked. The best anti-poverty program in the world is a job. That's the bottom line. Congressman Peter DeFazio is with us, representing Oregon's 4th District, and one of the tireless and most progressive fighters in Washington, D.C. Bernie Sanders has been on the show every week for 4 years or more. And Congressman Bernie is constantly saying to me, "You're so lucky to have Peter DeFazio in the legislature in Oregon representing you guys." So welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the opportunity.
What's going on in Washington, D.C. with regard to any hope at all for putting this economy back together? And what are your thoughts on all this? I'll let you characterize what your thoughts are on this gas tax and price of gas conversation, shall we say.
Well, look, I mean, 1993, the federal gas tax, 18.4 cents a gallon. Gas, $1 a gallon, diesel, less than that. Today, federal gas tax, 18.4 cents a gallon. Gas in my district, over $3.70 a gallon. Diesel, about $4.30. It isn't the federal gas tax that's driven up the cost. What we need here is, first, the simplest and best thing to do is close the Enron loophole. There was a special exemption created for Enron in commodities, energy commodities trading, in 2000, and then it was amplified by another bill in the by the Republicans in 2005, that has created a huge off-the-books, totally unregulated, speculative market in a bunch of commodities, including crude oil. And the best analysts that I consult with say that probably 30 to 50 cents a gallon is pure speculation. That is, people have no intention. They're not involved in utilizing fuel or oil for production. They're just purely speculating financially.
Isn't that pretty much the case with food as well right now?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation, unfortunately, again, with a lot of the deregulation of commodities going on in those markets, too. So we could help with food. We could help with fuel. And, yeah, you're right. There'd be some – look at yesterday. Well, Goldman Sachs, while I was holding a hearing on this issue before my committee with the American Petroleum Institute there, the head apologist, you know, carrying on about, you know, the poor old refiners are losing money. I said, well, how can you be losing money when ExxonMobil made $10 billion last quarter? Aren't they a big refiner? Well, yeah, but they're losing money. I said, yeah, well, if they're losing money refining, they're making a heck of a lot more somewhere. But anyway, Goldman Sachs announces $200 a barrel of oil. Well, wouldn't it be nice? Maybe you should call Goldman Sachs and see if they'll tell you what their position was, how long they were on oil contracts before they knew they were going to release their report predicting 200, which drove up the price immediately, which they probably cashed in on for a few hundred million.
Isn't that illegal? I know it's not illegal for members of Congress to do that. I heard stories about people trading in stocks in Tom DeLay's office before he was driven out for his outrageous crimes and corruption. But I understand members of Congress and the staff of members of Congress can trade on inside information, whereas nobody else can. This is something Brian Barrett has been working to put an end to. But isn't it illegal for corporations to do that?
Well, you know, that's a good question. This is just a research report. It's not, you know, they weren't saying, you know, something in terms of a change of owner. I don't know. You know, that's a very good question, whether or not there is some theoretical Maginot line between their people in their research division who are about to predict $200 a barrel of oil and the people over there in their commodity speculation branch. You know, I'm sure they didn't know about it.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Okay, we have about a minute left.
So there's that. Okay, well, the second thing is OPEC. I've been, since Bill Clinton, back then I said, gee, there's got to be something they're violating. I'm against these free trade agreements, but there are rules. We have to pay penalties. How about OPEC? And my staff researched it back during the Clinton presidency. Sure enough, they're violating the OPEC members, and I think there's seven or eight of them who are in the WTO, are violating the rules, Article 11 of OPEC. Now Hillary Clinton and others are picking up on my suggestion, you know, that would be a good move for the United States of America to make.
Let's
stand up to the oil sheiks.
Right. Break up all OPEC, or at least call out their illegal cartelization of
the make them pay a penalty, just like we're having to pay penalties to prohibit Internet gambling in the United States.
There
we
you go.
Pay penalties to have that law.
Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon. Congressman, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up tomorrow, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman will be taking your calls, plus Christy Harvey. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.